Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Andy Murray, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph and with Eurosport, and myself, David Law from BBC Radio 5 Live, joined by Catherine Whittaker from Eurosport inside the Eurosport green room. But it is deserted, aside from Lucy, the producer, who is here waving at the moment here on the Tennis Podcast. Just us and a bit of Chris Bradnam commentary in the background on the tennis that's come today. And Catherine, we have had one heck of a day today. I think one of the days that we will probably remember for the rest of our tennis supporting lives. And I'm sure all of you listening to this will as well. I mean, maybe Roger Federer and Venus Williams and Serena Williams are not your favourite players. Maybe they are. But nobody can argue with the significance of today. And let's take it in reverse order. Roger Federer beating Stan Wawrinka in five sets. I mean, it was a stunning 3 hours. I mean, pretty quick in terms of the sets, but goodness me, it felt like a big deal to that, did it? Really did.
Felt like a big deal. Was as big a deal as you can get on a tennis court, really. I mean, I very rarely get nervous about recording a tennis podcast because it's just, you know, having a chat to David Law about tennis. But the task of trying to sum up with mere words what took place today and what is going to take place over the weekend is a formidable one, really. And I doubt whether I'm up to it because almost exactly like Roger Federer's celebration upon winning in that fifth set, I was stood in front of the big screen wondering whether we'd get... I was sort of charting, going back through the various celebrations we saw after the third round victory against Burdick and after the fourth round victory over Nishikori. And then I suppose it dialed back a bit after the victory over Misha Zverev. And I thought maybe we'll get just this enormous outpouring of emotion. And of course, if he's going to cry, I'm going to cry. And then I've got to go on the telly and, oh, goodness me. But it was almost too much. It seemed like it was too much for him to react that way. And in fact, it was sort of... he was dazzled by it all himself. And that's a bit how I feel. I'm delighted it was as wonderful a battle as it was. I'm gutted for Stan. I think he's a wonderful player to have in our sport. But Federer fan or not, and I do completely accept that not everyone is... I think I also genuinely believe most are, but each to their own, not everybody is. But if you're a tennis fan, if you're a genuine tennis fan, you cannot not celebrate the story of Roger Federer reaching the final here, because it is one of the best the sport has ever seen. And that's just reaching the final. So goodness knows.
It's movie-like, really, is how I thought as it was going along. The way this has happened, 6 months out of the sport, I had the privilege of commentating on that fifth set on the radio, and you know, trying to sum it up or put it into perspective. I mean, I have no idea if I did that accurately or fairly or did it justice or not. But in terms of that moment, it was right up there in terms of significant moments that I certainly commentated on in 15 years. I think Andy Murray reaching world number one was an enormous moment at the end of last year. But historically, and bear in mind what Andy Roddick said a couple of days ago on this show about, you know, this is the most significant final in the history of the sport, in possibly if Federer plays Nadal, given what's on the line, Grand Slam titles-wise. Even putting that aside, the fact that the guy has not reached the final here for 7 years. The fact that he has been out of the game for 6 months, and who knows how close he was to maybe not being able to get over that knee injury. You know, it could have been too serious. Fortunately for him, it wasn't. But to come straight back out again and go all the way. I mean, okay, I feel like, yes, to some degree, the fortunes have to favour in a way, and you know, it happens to have happened when Novak Djokovic is suffering a slump, Andy Murray's suffering a slump. But that's sport. That is sport. And he's managed to come out and play brilliant tennis and take advantage. And here he is in the final. And, you know, it's on now. And if we were to think back a few podcasts ago, we had this discussion. We've had it probably for the last 18 months. And I really don't think that we thought he was going to win another one. I really don't.
Hang on. I've said all along that he would win another one.
In the last year.
Yeah, I've stood by it. Yeah, I've sounded less confident about it, but I've not done an about turn. You and your he'll take our breath away one last time.
I said that. Yeah, but nonsense. I said that about 5 years ago when he was really struggling, and even you were sort of looking at me as if to say, "Oh, I hope
no,
you're
no."
Right.
I said you put me on the spot and said, "Will he win another slam?" I said yes, and I've stood by it ever since. He still might not. I don't know. But you're going to say, oh, he's taken our breath away, hasn't he? He's taken our breath away.
Oh,
but you know what? The very first thing that Lucy and I recorded here at the Australian Open on camera was a piece to camera with Mark Petchy giving his thoughts generally on the tournament. And I asked him about Roger Federer and I put him on the spot and I said, can he win? And he was really punchy. He said, no, he can't win. And I don't say that to make Mark Petchy look a fool, because I don't think he does look a fool, because I don't think Roger Federer thought he could win for a moment, you know. And if Federer didn't think he could win, and I think it's safe to say Federer's always been pretty confident in his abilities over the years, then why should the likes of us think he could have done
it? I thought he had no chance at the start of this tournament, and particularly when he played those first two rounds, I thought, no way, no way. I remember having a conversation with Russell Fuller on the air about the Burdick match, and we were sort of weighing it up, and I said I think he can win this one, because I do feel like at some point Federer is going to soon make us just remember how great he is. He will give us a reminder. I didn't think that would extend to reaching the final of this tournament, not for a minute.
I felt like going into this one he was still capable of winning any given match on his day. I still felt like in any one night or day he could produce tennis to beat anyone. I just didn't think he could do it seven times in a row. He still hasn't done it seven times in a row. He's done it six times in a row, but that was what I doubted. And I know it's so fantastically corny, but if it is a Federer Nadal final, that is a victory in itself. And Federer said as much. I mean, the facts are that he has probably five times the chance of winning if it's Dimitrov in the final. That's the way I see it. I think he wants to play Nadal in the final.
Because
he's a tennis fan. And I love that.
I remember being at the ATP finals in 2000 in Lisbon when Andre Agassi reached the final. And it was going to be either Gustavo Kuerten or Pete Sampras that he would face. And he was asked, who do you want to face in the final? And he said, me and Pete Sampras have just been doing this too long. I want to play Pete Sampras. That's meant to be. That's who we are. That's what. And he didn't. In the end, Kuerten reached the final, and Kuerten won the final, and he was fantastic. But these sort of people share a bond that we will never know. Normal human beings who don't play sport at that level and have never had a rivalry like that. That's why these players, even if they've been on the wrong end of a rivalry, talking to Roddick about this, he doesn't mind the fact that he got dominated by Roger Federer throughout his career. He shared that rivalry. He was part of that. He was defined by that. He knows that. He was defined by the fact that he had his career while Roger Federer had his career. So that meant something to him. The same is true of John McEnroe and Bjorn Borg. They talk about each other with such affection. I know Agassi and Sampras have had their moments and fallen out, but they would not be the same without each other. Their careers would not mean as much without each other. And that's how Federer and Nadal feel.
Yeah, their rivalry is not only a Federer-defining rivalry or a Nadal-defining rivalry. They each know that it's an era-defining rivalry, and that era felt like it was over. And we're having just a little, you know, back to the future moment, which is just wonderful. Partly because we all know it's only going to be temporary. You know, we're not going to be saying these words for the French Open or Wimbledon or the US Open. So we've just got to enjoy it. And I do encourage, even if you're not a Federer fan, please trust me that this is good for the sport. If you're a tennis fan, it is good for the sport. It really is. This is the most magical storyline. And yes, I do believe the most magical storyline would be Federer and Nadal. But Fed playing baby Fed's pretty good as well. So we're in, as a sport, at this Grand Slam, and we'll come on to Serena and Venus in a moment, we're standing in pretty fine stead, I think.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
We'll preview Nadal against Dimitrov a little bit later in the show. We'll hear from the coach of Grigor Dimitrov, Danny Valverde, here on the Tennis Podcast. Fascinating to talk to him. Somebody I've known a lot in terms of seeing him around, but I've never really had a chance to talk to him. Found it really interesting to do so. We'll hear from him. But you mentioned the other stories of the day, and it started with Venus Williams reaching the final, beating Coco Vandeweghe in three sets. Really good match, first of all. That was a highly competitive match. Vandeweghe won the first set. Venus, I mean, and she said as much in her post-match press on-court interview, her deliriously happy, ecstatic reaction. But she also said, you know, I had to play really good defense today because this woman was just knocking me off the court, Coco Vandeweghe, the way she had been with so many other players. And I think, I mean, her experience was came to bear in that match.
Yeah, absolutely. She doesn't always... She's so deceptive with how well she moves and covers the court because she's not a graceful mover in the way that Roger Federer is, or even the way that, I mean, Serena, I think, is a more graceful mover. She's got these incredibly long limbs and you think there's absolutely no way she's going to be able to move herself around a tennis court the way she does. But suddenly she's just there. She's got to the ball, you know. Vandeweghe's hitting these huge shots and opening up these angles, and Venus is there, and I think her reach at the net is an enormous weapon. So few players on the women's side of the game are as good at the net as I'd like to see. You know, I think that's an underexploited tactic and weapon in women's tennis, frankly. But Venus is there, you know, showing how useful it can be. And yes, those long limbs help incredibly. Her coverage of the net is awesome. But yes, her experience, her sereneness, her serenity throughout the whole match, in such stark contrast to her reaction upon winning, was incredible. I mean, I was expecting an outpouring of emotion, but her celebration was Serena-like. That's that's what was funny about it. That's how I would expect Serena to. She did that pirouette that Serena does. She does the dancing that Serena sometimes does. That's what struck me about it. Venus is sort of the calm one, the elder statesman, the okay, just a bit cooler about things, isn't she?
She was beside herself.
She was beside herself, and she was. It was like she was doing a Serena Williams victory impersonation. It was really interesting.
And it was really heartwarming. I thought, because, you know, she's obviously bottled that up for so long, probably not really allowed herself to imagine that moment too much. And even in the match, you can't, can you? You sometimes see these cool, calm, collected tennis players, and then the moment of victory, you realise just how much they're having to stay focused in the moment and not project forward.
And speaking of focus, I understand that Serena and Venus passed in not quite the corridor, but in the players' area, as Venus was coming off court and Serena was about to walk on, as she had somehow had to not go over and congratulate her sister, she kept the stony face, and I'm sure that's exactly what Venus would have wanted her to do, and perhaps they'd even discussed how to deal with that moment. I've no idea, or maybe there's just some sort of unspoken understanding, or maybe they've dealt with that so many million times before that doesn't need to be spoken about. But I just can't imagine being able to maintain that kind of focus. Your 36-year-old sister, and I don't want to keep harping on about her age, because it's sensational despite the fact she's 36, and I feel sorry for her that everyone keeps hammering the word 36 in her face as if she's some sort of pensioner. But the fact is, in tennis terms, that she is. I couldn't believe that when I heard that. I assumed that Serena would have known that she had won. There's no way she could have completely blocked out that match and what was happening. But the fact that they caught sight of one another in the corridors, I find just, oh, to be a fly on the wall.
Yeah, and it's particularly special that this is all happening at the same time, that there's Serena, there's Venus, there's Roger Federer, and there may be even Rafael Nadal. I mean,
and there's the Bryan brothers.
There's the Bryan brothers, yeah. Today I was watching them first thing when I got in today, and that's their 10th Australian Open final, their 30th Grand Slam final, they're 38 years of age. I mean, it is... What is going on?
I don't know. I do wonder, I want to speak to someone, I'm sure there'll never be an answer. Did Wimbledon ever confess to deliberately engineering things to slow down the game a bit? I don't know if they ever have done, but
they've never admitted to it.
No,
I mean, they've always said that they didn't change anything. But I mean, there was a shift, wasn't there, between 2001 and 2002, from when Goran Ivanišević won it, beating Henman in the semis and then Rafter in the final. Then the next year you had Leighton Hewitt, David Nalbandian and Xavier Melis in the semi-finals, and Tim Henman was playing, and he said it was like a pudding, you know, that comparatively speaking.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was one of those things where it was just so stark. Is there a greater contrast between Goran Ivanišević and Leighton Hewitt? And it's the same here. It's such an enormous contrast. You have to wonder whether... I have no idea. I have no insider knowledge on this at all. I'd like to. I'd like to try and get a hint from somebody as to whether that's the case. But it's just such a massive thing that it's hard to believe that it's not a conscious decision. It's hard. It's hard to believe.
I'm going to go and hunt down Craig Tiley tomorrow.
Like you hunted down Dominic Thiem and put him. For it, please. Yeah.
I did have a good chat with Craig Tiley the other day about scheduling of players, which was quite interesting. He's a very approachable guy, but I think he's a very good tournament director. And if he has concocted to speed up these courts, it's for the better, in my opinion. And Nadal is still there. You know, he's proof that, you know, if you're good enough and you're playing well enough, you can play on anything. But it certainly has aided people's ability to come forward. There's no question about it. And Serena Williams today, we're just watching a few highlights of her at the moment on Eurosport, beating Mirjana Lucic-Baroni.
The highlights are pretty much the whole match, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't take long, because Serena has hit that zone now, and she hit it against Joe Konta. We'll talk more in depth, I think, tomorrow ahead of the final between the two of them, so we can do a proper preview. I think we need to let the thoughts percolate between Venus and Serena.
I love the word percolate.
Okay, I've said a good word finally.
Favourites.
Oh, good. So that's to come in tomorrow's tennis podcast. But Serena Williams, she does look now the business again. I mean, this is the thing about her and Federer. I mean, to some degree, Venus Williams as well. How are these people in their mid-30s playing like this? I mean, it didn't used to happen. I was talking to somebody today about Pete Sampras, his final tournament. You know, he was 31. And I think he was 31. And he felt old, you know? He felt like an old tennis player. Physically, he looked older than Roger Federer does right now, who's 35.
He dropped way further behind the rest. He was far less of a talked-about contender than even Federer was here, coming in as the 17th seed. You know, he'd been through that second-round George Bastl defeat on court two at Wimbledon and... Yeah, you're right, though. He looked old. You know, these guys don't look old. And I sometimes stop myself and I wonder, is it just because I'm older that these people don't look old? But I don't think it is, I think. I mean, obviously...
You look quite good for your age, Catherine.
The revolutions in... For your age. That's when things get bad, when people start tagging "for your age" onto the end of compliments.
I don't even get the first bit.
Oh, dear. Yeah, I mean, obviously, things seem to move on by the week in terms of sort of food science and athletic science and all of that. And I'm sure that plays a part in it. But I also just think these, you know, it's evolution, isn't it? These people push themselves on. It's sort of survival of the fittest. And you just have to be better and get better in order to compete.
Do you know, I think the other thing to just mention was we're seeing at the moment the lovely moment where Mirjana Lucic-Brauni takes a selfie of herself in front of the crowd who are going crazy for her, even in defeat. I think the other thing that those three players, Serena Williams, Venus Williams and Roger Federer, share in common is just a deep love of the basics of the sport. They love hitting tennis balls. They love training. They love being out in front of the crowd and the adulation and all that comes with it. Pete Sampras, I was around him a lot in the latter stages of his career. He had tired of it all. He didn't really want to do it anymore, to be honest. He wanted the records. I think there's a bit of that with Serena. She's desperate for the records. Once she's got the records, I'm not sure whether she'll stick to it and you know, want to carry on even longer or not. But there is a love for the game that is very innocent with those three, and I think that is key to longevity.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah, no, I know we have to maintain a certain sort of journalistic impartiality, but my sort of expressing being a Federer fan comes from being a tennis fan. I think I've made that point already. I think you've hit the nail on the head. They must just love the sport in the absolutely purest form of the sport. And, you know, I made the point about Federer, I think, after the Hopman Cup. He needs tennis as much as tennis needs him. He doesn't think he's doing tennis any favours by making the final here. He thinks tennis is doing him the favours by giving him the opportunity to get to the final here. And that's fantastic.
So that was today. Now we've got Rafael Nadal against Grigor Dimitrov. It's a battle I enjoy watching. The head-to-head is 7-1 in the favour of Rafael Nadal, but Dimitrov's won their most recent match. When they faced each other here 3 years ago, when Dimitrov was starting that run under Roger Rashid, it was four sets. It was really close. He could have taken 2-1 advantage Dimitrov that day. I think he's a better player now. I think he's a more complete athlete. And I think he's going to put in a great performance tomorrow. I really do. What do you think?
I agree. I don't think he's going to wilt under the spotlight or the occasion. I think he's going to give a really creditable account of himself. I tip Nadal. He's got a very genuine chance. I do tip Nadal. But I don't see the storyline as being... Grigor Dimitrov blows the big opportunity. I think he'll play great, but just get outplayed.
I think the nice thing about it is that we are at least seeing now the Grigor Dimitrov that we hoped one day to see again after 2 years in the utter wilderness. Now, one of the reasons that he's made this resurgence appears to be his association now with new coach Dani Valverde. We had a chance to speak to Danny ahead of this tennis podcast and ahead of the semi-final, and we asked him how he first got together with Grigor, when it first started to become reality, and what exactly happened.
We met after he was done in Wimbledon last year, went over to his house and just had a chat about how he was feeling and what his plans were and where his mindset was at the moment. And he was just looking for a change and was looking to find some motivation in his tennis. And I had a very honest chat with him and told him my point of view, and I'll keep that between the two of us. But it's been going great, to be honest. All credit to him. He's been working extremely hard. He's very open to listening, not only to me, but to the fitness trainer, the physio, his agents. So he's been excellent to work with. He does as he's told all the time. So that's very nice to have as a coach. So to be honest, I think the whole team is doing a great job, but he's doing a great job himself at listening to us and putting in the hard work.
Because every player is different, aren't they? You can't necessarily coach, I imagine, Grigor the way you coached Andy or Thomas.
No, definitely. You need to be open to understanding the player as a person on and off the court. That's probably the most important part about my job, is being able to adjust and being able to listen to what the player has to say, so you can adjust to the player. It's like you said, it's coaching him and or coaching Andy or Thomas is all going to be extremely different, and I need to be able to adapt my system to him. At the same time, I need to follow my beliefs and do what's right from my side. But it's been great working with him. He's very open. We connect on many levels when it comes to tennis and off the court. So it's been a good match from the beginning.
I fully respect that you don't want to reveal the contents of that conversation, but in terms of getting the best out of him, what do you think is required? What has helped him to get to this point?
From the beginning, we've been focusing on his strengths. I think that was key to getting his confidence back and getting back to winning matches. We try to keep things as simple as possible on the tennis court, just focusing on his strengths, which are his serve and his forehand and his movement. So for the first few months, we're only focusing on that. And once a player has the weapons working, then you can add a few things around it. We're still working on that. We're still in the first stage of the job, and hopefully we can work on some other things in the future. But it's going well for now. He's accepted the process that we're going through, and he's very committed to it, so it's good for me as well.
Well, he's a charming guy, isn't he, Daniel Valverde? He was a little bit shy about doing interviews at all when I initially approached him. You know, he was not keen on being in front of the camera particularly. He said, I don't really like doing TV interviews. He was going to speak to me because I've known him a little bit from afar for a while, and it was going to be radio, and he thought, yeah, okay, I'll do that. And he was going to speak to a few of the press boys. He spoke to you as well for Eurosport. But when he speaks, I mean, you know, you're thinking, why are you nervous? I mean, he's so articulate, he's so sort of calm and interesting and very convincing. I can see why he's an effective coach.
Oh, he speaks brilliantly well. And as you say, so calm. I can completely understand why it's working with Grigor. He's got, I can imagine him, when he was with Andy Murray, I couldn't quite imagine him, you know, being stern when required. And the fact that he brought Lendl into the team suggested, you know, Danny was there for the arm around the shoulder, and then Lendl was there for the stern talking to. I suspect now he's sort of stepped up to that senior coaching role. He's better able to tread the line and can do both. But it seems to be more about the arm around the shoulder and everybody talks about it, doesn't it, with Grigor. He can play every single shot. He's had too much at his disposal for so long, and I think that's something that people don't talk about enough with Federer, his problem solving on the court. He problem solved that match today. He was in serious trouble. Wawrinka was the massive favourite in that fifth set, and Federer had to change things to get the better of Wawrinka. And even in, you know, these early stages of that fifth set, I totally thought he was going to lose it, and he had to change his tactics considerably in order to do it. And that mental aptitude for the sport is, tennis intelligence is sort of too puerile a way of putting it, but just knowing your game and knowing how to apply it and all of that, Dimitrov has lacked that. And somehow Danny Valverde seems to be helping him with that. I think it's partly the emotional comfort side of things and partly a tactical awareness, but it's working. It's really, really working.
I think the other thing is he's figured out some straightforward patterns of play for Grigor Dimitrov to win points. You know, these are your go-to patterns. If things aren't going well, this is what you do. You do A or you do B or you do C. You don't just faff around doing A, P, Q, whatever else you might be able to throw at a board.
Which all the top players have. I mean, yes, Federer can produce tweener lob winners, but most of the time you're serving a big serve and hitting an in-to-out forehand winner. That's how he wins the majority of his points on service games. So that's absolutely the way to go.
Talking about problem solving, did you like the little arrogant text I sent you just after match point when I said I picked the moment mid-rally that I saw the momentum changing in Federer Wawrinka?
It was deeply modest. Did you also say on air that this whole Federer run started with a long chat with David Law in the player garden?
I didn't say that, but remind me.
It could have been one of those, what do they call it, butterfly flapping wings moments, you know, a small human incident affecting the course of history. That, the butterfly effect, yes, weird, rubbish movie with Ashton Kutcher. That chat with David Law has affected the course of sporting history forevermore.
Yeah, quite right. Quite right. I was also thinking about 2003, my first ever Australian Open.
It's all about David Law.
It's definitely
not about
me.
Roger Federer. It's about David Law.
Forget him. I mean, you know, I'm responsible for him. It's simple as that. 2003, I found a photo of myself interviewing Andre Agassi when I didn't have grey hair, when I had brown hair, and I look about 12. And at that point, what's significant for the story is that was my first year here, and that was the last time Serena played Venus, the only time they played each other in the final. Roger Federer had not yet won a Grand Slam. He lost in the fourth round to David Nalbandian. Andy Murray, Novak Djokovic and Rafael Nadal were children. And
so was I. Just
don't rub it in.
I mean, you've already sort of insulted my age, so I just thought I'd get that in there.
Well, and I looked a bit younger than I do now as well. But anyway, a small aside.
I mean, there's too many stats and facts. There's too many now. I know yesterday I was saying I want these things to happen because I've got all these great stats about ages and stuff. There's just too much now. There's too much history being made, too much throwback, too many mind-boggling stats being thrown out there.
Are you going to be able to handle this or
can't
not?
Can't process it all.
You've still got 2 or 3 days to go. Are you going to get through it?
I don't know.
Come on, you've got to be on the telly tomorrow. And you've got to do tennis podcasts. 3 more of those as well, at least.
What do you mean, at least?
All right, 3 more after this one. Anyway, we haven't finished this one yet.
Not doing one on the plane, David.
Well,
we are not podcasting on the plane. Your energy might extend to that, but mine doesn't.
I wonder if that's legal. Are you allowed to podcast on planes? I wonder.
You're allowed to Wi-Fi on planes now. That feels like...
I don't like that.
...the future.
I don't like that. I don't like to be contactable on a plane, do you?
Yes, I very much do.
I dislike that immensely because that's when I get my year's worth of film watching in.
Not sleeping. Heaven forbid, David.
No, I don't want to do any of that. Right, anyway, we're talking to sleep. That's what we're going to do right now. The tennis will be back tomorrow, of course. Eurosport's coverage of Rafael Nadal against Grigor Dimitrov. It's an evening session match, so it'll be in the morning, UK time, at 8 o'clock. Catherine showed me with her 8 fingers and thumbs. And we've obviously got BBC Radio.
Build up with me and Pat Cash. Studio with Annabelle, Greg, Rob Curling. Lucy's saying 8:30. No,
8:30 the match.
Studio coverage.
All right, okay. Yeah, anyway, in the morning, when you wake up, stick your telly on and the tennis will be on, all right? And then we've also got that on BBC Radio 5 Live Sports Extra. You'll be able to listen to live commentary on there. And we've got the Eurosport player that you can get if you're out and about and you want to watch the match. You've got a year's worth for $19.99. You get the other slams. I mean, come on. Brilliant. And we've also got Simon Briggs in the Telegraph who's going to...
Lucy just fist pumped.
He's going to write all this stuff. Simon Briggs is going to write all these articles, and Oliver Brown's in town as well. He's the feature sports writer. Yeah,
is he? That tells you what a big story Federer reaching the final is.
Yeah, it's a big deal, I'll tell you.
That does tell you something, doesn't it? Because usually it would only be for a Murray reaching the final or Konta that the extra British staff would be sent in from a British paper.
Yeah, it's a big old story this. I hope you're enjoying it. We certainly are, and we'll be back with another tennis podcast tomorrow. Stick well, bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.